Thank you, Ursula, on a Monday. How was the weekend? Good?
Beautiful.
I'm stalling to find out who my host is. I know it is not Tom. By the way, somebody said to me on Saturday while at the Maple Valley Rotary that I'm not showing enough sympathy for Tom. So a quick update on his condition, Jacob.
He's still bedridden, but I think he's doing okay.
And now say something compassionate.
I'm sorry? Wait, what? Sorry, I was taken off guard. I should say something more compassionate than that. I'm very worried about his condition, but I think he's doing okay.
We miss him terribly.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Okay, there we go. Here comes the co-host.
Felix the cat.
Yes.
The wonderful, wonderful.
The man whose name, his last name, speaks volumes about him as a person. Your last name is?
Bunnell.
Bunnell.
With an E. No, Bunnell with an E.
Bunnell isn't boring.
At least you used my last name. For the first 2 years, I did stuff that you never mentioned my last name.
I'm not good with last names. You should know that right away, Mr. Bunnell. You ready to go?
Yeah, where did Al Stewart go? I wanted my real theme music.
No, because it's it has too many meanings to it, and it's too clunky to get it started. You ready?
Okay, let's go.
Say something compassionate about Tom.
I love Tom, but why can't you be bedridden? Can you just wheel him into the studio?
And that's just, what I don't
the
understand.
The microphone's adjustable, right?
I didn't want to say that. I was waiting for you to say it, but he hurt his leg. It's not like his jaw got disconnected or his tongue flew out of his mouth.
Yeah, I assume for all of his career he's been bedridden at least 8 hours a day, right?
Comes Hannah Scott. She'd be in here with a flu or, you know, she's flying out all parts of her body. Doesn't matter. She's that type of gal.
No limbs.
No.
I am thinking about you, though, Tom. Hope you're doing all right.
Oh, that's enough. Come on. Yeah, all right. So the lopsided eye, 1634. This is the stop other cities from taxing our food.
Right. So it's they tried to have groceries in the ballot title. That got overtaken in court. Mm-hmm. Now it's just anything for human consumption. But here's the deal. I-1634, it's already illegal in our state for local governments to tax grocery items like fruits, vegetables, milk, bread, mm-hmm. etc. So this is really about stopping the spread of Seattle's recently passed sugary beverage or soda tax.
Yep.
Now, the Yes campaign has raised $13 million. Almost all of that is from soda companies. Coke, Pepsi, Red Bull are in there. Mm-hmm. That's compared to just under $8,000 for the No campaign, which is supported by the health advocates. Initiative backer Pete Lamb was on with KTTH's Jason Rantz, and he says if there's going to be a soda tax, it needs to be at the state level.
We wanted to be preemptive and put a clear line in the sand saying, no, you should not touch food, you should not touch beverages. This is a proactive approach to making it very clear that this should not be done on a local level.
So if I-1634 should pass, here's what it would do.
That local governments cannot impose taxes on food or grocery items. So counties and cities could not impose taxes like this. It can still come up in the legislature. The legislature could still propose or vote in a tax there. But we think that, you know, if this is passed overwhelmingly and the polls are showing strong support for it, we think that it sends a very clear message not only to local communities and municipalities, but also to the state legislature as well.
Now, what it would not do is repeal Seattle's soda tax,
right.
But it would block that one from going any higher and make it so nobody else, no other cities or counties could do it.
So the history is, because Felix loves history.
Yeah.
1977, did they stop us from taxing food?
Yeah,
right?
through initiative. Yeah.
Through initiative. Okay. So in this case, they're not doing all food. It's for particular foods that they find are detrimental to the health of the people.
Yeah, this is a big health issue.
Yeah, they're trying to use the tax as a disincentive, right? But it's unclear if it's working, and there's this big study coming out in a few days, right?
Yeah, it's coming out on the 22nd. So it's UW and I think King County Public Health in Seattle joined up, and they're doing a study to see what the Seattle tax has done, whether it's a variety of things, but including whether it's discouraged people from consuming soda, whether they're crossing into the other jurisdictions where you can,
right.
And all of this. What we do know, though, is that Seattle, in the first 6 months that this was in place, took in way more money than they thought, which suggests maybe people are still buying soda, but we'll wait for the study. So it's like $10 million bucks.
Yeah, inconvenience charge, not really a disincentive. Maybe. Yeah. Who knows?
So will I-1634 pass?
Polling apparently good. We'll see.
Polling good, meaning polling, it will pass.
It would pass. Yeah, it was quoted into the polls. But we'll see. We'll
okay.
See.
I'm thirsty. I don't know about you. You want a Coke? Or
they're running.
I brought some in from Snohomish County.
No. I'd go to White Center.
You might not want. Should we make fun of the ad? Let's get Hannah out of here.
Right.
Hannah. man. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
They're spending a tremendous amount of money, the folks that are trying to stop the tax here.
With radio ads, thank God. I love it. I love political season here for the radio business. Yay.
So we shouldn't make fun of it necessarily, but have you been listening to any of the ads? They do have sort of an apocalyptic feel to them. Like, it's not just taxing soda. And they also do a really good job of never mentioning soda, Pepsi, Coke, nothing. None of that is really, until the end, they tell you who sponsored the thing to let you know how it goes.
Yeah, they're trying to tap into people's emotions. All good political ads, it's not the issue. It's the emotions that it generates. So.
Okay, do you want to do one?
Yeah, you going to go first?
You want to
finish strong. You want me to do my little lame little thing? You're gonna
you got a history
strong.
One?
I got sort of an Americanism, jingoistic
right, Andrew,
one.
Andrew, sad, lonely kind of piano music. I got it right here. Okay. Hang on. You ready? Hang on.
So you want me to go first?
That'll help.
Valley Forge. Gettysburg.
Nice.
Normandy. Da Nang. Places where our fathers, grandfathers, and other patriots did what was right to defeat the enemy.
Good.
Now, we face a new threat. Taxes on necessities like soda pop, milk, apples, and other American foods, maybe even hard-boiled eggs. Who knows where it might end? This time around, it stops with me and I-1634. Vote yes on Tuesday, November 6th.
Nice. Like all the history references. That's good.
Yeah. I don't know. Is Gettysburg a patriotic thing, or does that stir up memories of the South? That probably was a bad choice.
Moving on.
Okay.
I do the old lady.
My grandchildren mean the world to me. They're growing up so fast. Now the government wants to raise my taxes. I can't afford more taxes. Food is expensive enough. If my taxes go up, I might have to eat cat food. I don't want my grandbabies watching me eat cat food out of a little can.
Paid for by the committee to pass I-1634.
There we go. Trump sends Pompeo immediately to Saudi Arabia. If you've been following the story. So a journalist that was in Turkey went into the Saudi Arabian embassy in order to get papers so he could marry a woman. And when he went in there, they have video of him going in. Prior to that, there was video of a plane landing from Saudi Arabia. 15 guys got off the plane, went into the Turkish embassy. They're in Saudi Arabia, and the guy never came out.
Yeah, but not just a journalist. Jamal Khashoggi, he's been an activist. He's been kind of a burr under the saddle of the Saudi regime for a while. He's been living in the United States for more than a year.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of direct ties to him as not an American citizen, certainly, but someone who America has protected over the last 18 months or so. And he goes into this embassy and disappears, or consulate.
So they said to his wife, who was sitting out in the hallway or in the lobby there, oh, you might have missed him on his way out.
Yeah.
You might have missed him on his way out because he went through the back door dead. They don't know what happened. They think maybe it might have been sort of a kidnapping or trying to get him, and something went terribly wrong. But now it seems like pretty sure that Saudi Arabia was responsible for the death of this journalist.
Yeah, and if you're President Trump or in the American government, it's very inconvenient because we depend on Saudi Arabia for oil and for buying our military goods.
Yes.
And so the Trump administration has been fairly slow to respond with anything other than words at this point. There's no action taken, no economic sanctions discussed, nothing on the table at this point. But now Pompeo is sent over there to who knows what.
Well, the problem for the Trump administration and for the American defense industries is that it was a big check that Saudi Arabia was going to write to Boeing and to all the others that build all this stuff, these bombs and planes and things. So Trump said, listen, if we don't provide it for them, somebody else will come along and provide it for them. So let's give them the military assets that they want. It's going to benefit the United States and, period, new paragraph, indent. We'll look into this thing and we'll do what we can in order to make sure Saudi Arabia never does something like this again.
But what about this most latest theory? As Trump said, it might have been rogue killers who were responsible for Khashoggi's disappearance. And nothing to do with the Saudi regime. They just happened to be inside the consulate that day.
Possibility.
Exactly.
Possibility.
And who knows? Khashoggi might not have been born in Saudi Arabia. Maybe he was born in Kenya.
Right.
We don't even know. Oh. We're not sure. I'm not sure. I haven't seen the paper yet.
The president was on yesterday on 60 Minutes, and he had an opportunity to kind of push back against Leslie Stahl and some of the stuff, some of the questions. And we've got – how many cuts are these? Is it some of the best that we've gotten here, Jacob, without
that's what I said.
Bashing on the president?
Yeah.
Trump backs against pushes back against the accusations his administration is in chaos. Okay, here we go. This will be good.
Out of hundreds and hundreds of people, some I could have not picked, I'm changing things around and I'm entitled to. I have people now on standby that will be phenomenal. They'll come into the administration. They'll be phenomenal.
More people going to go?
Yeah, other people will go, sure.
Because so many people. You have a kind of a record of turnover.
I told you the story. I told you the story. We have a great, I think I have a great cabinet. There are some people that I'm not happy with. I have some people that I'm not thrilled with. And I have other people that I'm beyond thrilled with.
What about General Mattis? Is he going to leave?
Well, I don't know. He hasn't told me that. I have a very good relationship with him. I had lunch with him 2 days ago. I have a very good relationship with him. It could be that he is. I think he's sort of a Democrat, if you want to know the truth. But General Mattis is a good guy. We get along very well. He may leave. I mean, at some point, everybody leaves. Everybody. People leave. That's Washington.
I like the idea of people being on standby to join the cabinet. Like there's some room somewhere where there's just sort of, you're kind of waiting. There's bad coffee. There's an intercom. You can go to here. It's being made out. And you get called to join the Trump cabinet because you're on standby and people leave.
He has people that he said, hey, listen, I might need you.
Yeah.
You know, I hate when they constantly compare this administration to every other administration. How many other reality television show hosts have we ever hired? I mean, come on. Oh, this is unprecedented. Absolutely unprecedented.
Yeah, there is a certain amount of fatigue, Trump coverage fatigue. Whether you're critical of Trump or not critical of Trump, there's just this fatigue because it's everywhere. It's like the new atmosphere. It's like liquid. It's all just surrounds everything.
They talked to some folks at Maple Valley Rotary on Saturday, and they're like, yeah, I'm so sick of all that Trump stuff. And these are people also that live outside the Seattle area. They said they're sick of the homeless. They're sick of the Trump stuff, all that bashing. I'm like, well, what else are we going to talk about for 3 hours? They said, well, just talk faster. So here's the president learning things on the job.
The other thing I've really learned is I never knew how dishonest the media was. I really mean it. I'm not saying that as a soundbite. I never knew how dishonest.
I'm going to change the subject again.
Well, no, but even the way you ask me a question, like about separation.
Yeah.
When I say Obama did it, you don't want to talk about it.
No.
Let's make a big deal.
I'm going to run your answer, but you did it 4 times.
I'm just telling you that you treated me much differently on the subject.
I disagree, but I don't want to have that fight with you.
Hey, it's okay.
Or have another fight with you.
Leslie, okay. It's okay. In the meantime, right. I'm president, and you're not.
I would say this. He deserves a lot of the negative stuff that he gets, and the media has to cover it. But if you're sitting there watching it like he does, constantly, all the time, a poll was done, 91% of most of the coverage on Donald Trump is negative. And they don't give him any credit on the economy, or he doesn't feel he gets enough credit on the economy. And he's constantly being compared to others. And if you sat there and you sort of wallowed and bathed in this thing every single day, he's fermenting himself in nothing but negative news because that's all that comes at him because the media hates him. And he now gets an opportunity to say he feels they're dishonest. What I think he might mean is they don't cover the other side as well, or they don't hold, they don't give him credit for the accomplishments that he makes, or not enough of a big deal about the things that he's doing well.
Well, I think like any public figure who uses the media to promote their agenda, he can't really complain. He uses it for however he can. If he gets coverage for anything, it doesn't end up being bad for him, whether he's saying something brilliant or something stupid or something, you know, racist or could be deemed racist or whatever. The media is there and covering it. He should be thanking them for all the coverage he gets. I mean, look, just ask Warren G. Harding or James Buchanan.
Oh, no,
face
no,
the same
no,
thing.
No, don't do that. did he deserve the criticism for what he said about Dr. Ford?
Had I not made that speech, we would not have won.
This is in, I think, Mississippi. He was talking about, he's up there, he goes, you know, she doesn't remember, she had one beer, she remembers that, but she doesn't remember when, she doesn't know what year, doesn't know what house, doesn't know how she got home.
Well, he started acting out, he started saying, where was it? I don't remember.
Right, he was quoting her.
Had I not made that speech, we would not have won. I was just saying she didn't seem to know anything.
No,
and you're trying to destroy a life of a man who has been extraordinary.
Why did you have to make fun of her?
I didn't really make fun.
Well, they were laughing.
What I said is the person that we're talking about didn't know the year, the time, the place, the way now Justice Kavanaugh was treated has become a big factor in the midterms. Have you seen what's gone on with the polls?
But did you have to?
Well, I think she was treated with great respect. I'll be honest.
But do you think
there
you
are those
treated
that think
her
she
with,
shouldn't have been?
Do you think you treated her with great respect?
I think so, yeah, I did.
But you seem to be saying that she lied.
I'm not going to get into it because we won. It doesn't matter.
Well,
we won.
There you go. By the way, you end every interview question with either "I'm president" or "we won." Which, you can't argue. Can't get around that.
They're correct answers. It works rhetorically to say all those things, whether it's something that people will aspire to and think like, "Hey, I want to be president someday," or "Hey, I love the values my country espouses through its chief executive." Maybe not.
You and I have gone round and round on this one like a couple of unneutered dogs. The idea that somehow the executive branch or the president of the United States is supposed to morally represent us.
Yeah.
I just cannot get anywhere near that idea. I don't give a rat's ass who's in that White House.
Really?
Doesn't mean, as long as you do not waste my money. If you tax me or you placate me or you make me feel like we're doing something for the children, don't lie to me. Just leave me alone. Yeah. Leave me alone. I wanted to have one of those don't tread on me T-shirts, but then people have pointed that thing back towards racism. So I'm like, oh, I don't have that thing on there. But just leave me alone. Take the money. But we don't need a whole bunch of extra stuff going on. You make people more dependent upon you, so you'll vote for this guy or that guy. Leave me alone.
But do you buy into the whole American exceptionalism thing?
Yeah, I think America, as its youth as a country and its ability to be able to allow individuals to have freedom above anything else, allowed it to flourish the way it does. Because the beautiful thing about money and capitalism, it takes two people that absolutely hate each other and in some regards don't even speak the same language, and they all agree with one thing. That $5 is worth $5, and it's $5, and it's $5. And I agree that it's $5, and you agree it's $5. I can't stand you. But because you and I have made the agreement that that money has this value and it will be able to provide me this service or this good, allows everybody to come together. It's the peace of capitalism.
Yeah.
The peace of capitalism. Get the government out of it as much as possible. Yeah. We don't need you to lead us morally.
No, but see, I love capitalism just as much as the next guy.
No, you don't.
I do. Oh, I do. Are you kidding me? Oh, I love America. I love how the culture that has been fostered by capitalism over the last 100 years with the mass culture, the really vulgar mass culture and music and print material and the web. I love that. And that's all a result of our capitalism and our society that we live in.
Yeah.
And that can exist right alongside any president, whether it's someone you think is a moral leader or someone who's not a moral leader. But I believe that the opportunity that a president has to be not a moral leader is probably not the right word, but just any group you're a part of. Usually the person who's in charge of it, whether it's a little small like a PTA group or a Cub Scout group or something, if you don't respect the person or you think their values are inconsistent with yours, you won't be as engaged. You won't do as much for it. You won't as a group be able to accomplish as much. And I think the ultimate social group we're all a part of in the United States is being citizens. Well, and if we're led by somebody who gets that and sees the value in community and the value in harnessing that immeasurable force that people have beyond how much money they can make. And again, I love money.
Yeah.
I wish I had half the money you have with your gold paved backyard and the riches of mammon in your wallet.
Right.
But I also think you can do that in a way that uplifts everybody and continues to be this example for the rest of the world. And I'm a sucker for that. My parents immigrated from Europe after World War II. I believe in immigration. I love America, all that stuff. I wave my flag. I beat up communists.
Right.
No, I don't do that. My dad did that. But I do think the things can exist side by side, and I think it's really critical. And I think you give it short shrift if you just focus on the money part of it.
I'll say this. I'm not focusing just primarily on it. Last part is this. The only way somebody succeeds is to create a division between one group and another. So you split everybody in half. Then you tell one group that they're horrible. You tell the other group that you're going to save them from the horrible people. Vote for me. So by the very nature of politics, it takes the state, splits it into two tribes, and then you just bash away at the other side and make your people feel like their life is in jeopardy if that other side gets. And that's how politics works. And once you get that person in there, then you try to reunite everybody again? It never works. Capitalism. We have to go to commercial break. All right. You will be
I'm going to be bedridden here in a few minutes.
Here we go. If I seem a little off today, it's because I did not have a BLT. Because you know I ate a BLT for 100 days straight. I go down there today, no more tea. They get the L and they get the B, but they don't have the T, and I can't just have a LT.
So this would be day 101? It ended just randomly? Or
today it ended.
Wow.
Back to eggs. Okay, hey, by the way, Laura Keel's got a great business, and she wants you to know about it. Laura's Home Loans. Of course, you recognize that name, Keel. You've been in the mortgage business at any time, that you're buying a house, going to refinance, get a pre-approval letter, anything you need done when it comes to that home, the most biggest investment you make in your life. Why not have the best people working with you? That's Laura Keel from Laura's Home Loans. Thanks for sponsoring the Tom and Curly Show. From 9 to noon, quick update on Tom. He is at home. He's on Advil. He's not on medicines. that would stop him from talking on the air. But tomorrow he finds out whether or not he needs surgery. And Felix is still wondering why he can't just come in here like in a bed.
Yeah, like a cabulance. We love Tom. We're just making fun of him.
Yeah, all right. I know you listen to Tommy Boy. All right, here we go. Getting started. By the way, a survey I've done 4,000 employees all across the United States. The question was, would you want to be a CEO? Guess what percentage of men said yes?
95?
36%. Ooh. What percentage of women said yes to wanting to become a CEO?
73.
18%. Ugh. Overall, just most people don't want the job. They know it just takes an awful lot of time. They don't want to have to deal with people. They like their jobs and their position in life. Being the top dog at the top of the pile does not seem to motivate a lot of people, especially when they realize, what do I have to give up in order to be the main guy or the main gal as a CEO? So there's a piece that we found that was in HPR.
Harvard Business Review.
Oh, yeah, sure. My backup school.
Safety.
I said, I'm going to spend the $25 and get that as a backup school with my application. So Dr. Matthew Lamont, who is with Southern Cross University, he's talking about the fact that he's defining serious leisure, that these CEOs, when they're asked about this stuff, they spend 2.1 hour a day in some type of thing known as serious leisure.
Now, when an individual pursues a leisure activity that they work hard at, that they intrinsically enjoy, and that they ultimately develop a social identity geared around that activity.
What around they?
How come all these dubious stories always have a guy from Australia talking about them?
He's geared.
This reflects a concept known as serious leisure. But the catch is that any kind of serious leisure, particularly amateur sport, requires a significant resource investment by the participant.
Mm-hmm. EA Sports CEO Andrew Wilson talked about how his hobbies help him to avoid much stress. I'm glad this cut's only 7 seconds. Already, we're 4 minutes into this and I'm bored.
I train a lot of Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and you know, when someone's trying to take your head off, you pretty much can only think about that, so that helps you switch off.
Yeah, I don't like when CEOs are seen as water skiing, like Branson, or that one guy that used to go around in the hot air balloon all the time that died.
What was that guy?
My brother wanted him to die. I said, why do you want that guy to die? He goes, I'm just so sick of, remember, he was a world adventurist and he was a hot air balloonist something.
Yeah, didn't they take off from Maine to try to get across the Atlantic? Did he die in a balloon accident?
Yes, okay. He did, appropriately enough. Just the idea, like, you know, oh, look at this guy, and here he is doing this, and here he is heli-skiing, and it's just like the rich guy that now all of a sudden, oh, we're supposed to feel sorry for him that he needs to go out there, or she needs to go out there and blow off some stress.
The balloon accident really cemented his brand, though, I think. This whole notion of serious leisure or serious leisure, it makes me think of like a serious leisure suit. But it's some sort of therapeutic thing for these hobbies. So they stop being hobbies. I don't really have any hobbies. Mm-hmm. All the stuff I do is related to the work I do or stuff I'm really into that has some ultimate expression in for clients or project I work on. So this notion of having to do jiu-jitsu or go water skiing or mountain climbing or rock climbing, whatever, it has this because your job is so intense, you need to get away.
Mm-hmm.
That seems kind of sad to me. What about just going downstairs and like doing a crossword puzzle or going out in the yard and playing jarts?
Well, good point. I think that what happens is that you get a certain amount of money, you have a certain amount of time, and you're surrounded by other people. Like a lot of these guys will do Ironman. The amount of time it takes to do an Ironman and the training and the money and the expense and everything else that goes into it, they just want to be able to have something else that they do with their time. I'm trying to Fawcett, I think his name was the guy that.
The one thing in this sort of list of sort of therapeutic reasons that resonates with me is this notion that strengthens authentic leadership. So if you're the leader of a company or a big organization and you're seen as this person who knows what's going on and is decisive and can act quickly, if you're doing some he-man type of activity or some sport or hobby that requires a lot of skill and dexterity and expensive accessories, then it makes you more authentic when you show up at the workplace. Like, oh, there's that guy who does all those brave, exciting things on the weekend. Here he is leading us through our next, 1% sales growth. Yay.
I would like to see the boss do a thing where you have a thing called beat the boss, where once a month you can challenge the boss to some type of activity, and the boss comes down and he's ready to go. And somebody who's really good at something takes him on and defeats him or her, and it allows the boss to have sort of a humbling experience.
Humanizes them, yeah.
Yeah, and then everybody then goes back up, and then, again, it inspires, whether it was a dunk tank or the person ends up shaving their head or some way in order to make the person feel more kind of one of you. The idea that the boss walking around and coming down, like, who is our boss here?
Can't remember.
Anybody? Jacob? Who's in charge?
Of what?
Of us?
There's like a team of managers.
Can you name one?
Yeah.
The guy that wears the blue jacket every once in a while.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So that's basically get the idea. When my father owned a business and he had 350 employees, as the CEO, he used to go out into the warehouse, this giant warehouse with all these medical supplies in it, and some of the guys would set up a hibachi in the warehouse, which I'm sure is not good,
oh.
And a barbecue stuff back there. And they would do it way in the back. They do it where there's a hole in the ceiling where some of the in the glass, so the smoke would go up, but not enough that you couldn't tell that they were running hibachi, right? Mm-hmm. And my dad used to walk out into the down into the warehouse and go, "Are they back there cooking again?" And I'm like, "I don't know, Dad," because I worked there when I was 14 years old. I said, "I think so." He goes, I smell chicken or something. So my father's making his way back, way, way back there. And there's six guys sitting around the hibachi at lunchtime. And my dad ended up sitting and eating with them. And that became a regular thing that he would go out there, even though it was a fire hazard. The idea that you would just be with everybody else and one of everyone else. You're mm-hmm. a leader when you can be. But the rest of the time, to be able to be sort of part of the crowd, I think, held him in higher regard among everybody.
Oh, and especially if there's not some committee that's been established to try to get things going, like barbecues and lunches. If your employees are naturally getting together on their own because they like to work with each other,
yes.
that should be supported. And yeah, your dad should have been out there every day. He should have been buying the chicken. I hope he was. Basting it personally himself and just serving it up in an apron and everything.
The good thing is when there was a flood, my dad said to a couple of the guys, "Hey, take some of those Band-Aids that aren't selling and throw them in the water so that we can write those off on insurance." And they did not hesitate at all for insurance fraud. And I think that was wonderful.
Loyalty, that's on the list here. I would guess a lot of the guys on this CEO list who are doing these exciting hobbies, they're probably under a certain age. 80% of this is for social media purposes, for enhancing their brand and for their next job and for their next the book they're going to write about how what a great CEO they are.
Yeah, good. By the way, I did something I've never done before. I went for a hike yesterday, ooh. And I got shushed by somebody walking by because I was talking too loud. As you know, I'm deaf in my right ear.
It is nature's cathedral.
It is what Tiger Mountain? Is that what it is? Oh, let's make it to the top. Yeah. It's long. It was a long walk. And then you get to the top. There's nothing up there. There's no vending machines, nothing. There's nothing to buy, nothing to see. And then you walk back down again. And I'm just thinking to myself, where's the payoff other than being yelled at by somebody? And then I also noticed, I go to use the bathroom. Oh, these people are in such great shape. Their diet does not look good. When you look into that big bucket that they've got in that room, it looks like they've got lots of other problems. But yeah, but I'm walking up a thing telling somebody how they should probably not buy the first sink that they find at Home Depot. Don't get for the cheap stuff. And some guy, just told me to keep it down.
There's a lot of echo up there. And was the guy who shushed you, did he have a trim beard and a fanny pack?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And a dog.
Yep.
All right. let's see. Are you a hiker?
I hear the mournful music starting in the background.
Andrew, what's this crap? Don't play this anymore.
All right.
Get this out of here. We'll take a break. We'll come right back. We're trying to do talk radio. Text us, Online Trade Academy, text line 98973, 98973. A challenge has gone out to Tom, who's not with us. He'll be here maybe next week. Somebody wants him to try to become letter of the day. All right, text us, Online Trade Academy, text line 98973. Felix the Cat filling in for Tom, and I think tomorrow Jim Dever is here.
So wow.
Sort of a whole cornucopia of hosts.
I saw that yellow pad in Brian Buckley's office with all those names crossed off way down at the bottom there. It wasn't even, didn't have its own line. It had half a line. It was my name.
I know.
And then the next
that.
Page was Jim Dever. So that's it's right. Like it's really deep, digging deep to
deep,
bring
deep
in.
Deep bench, deep bench. Let's see. Quick around the horn here. Do you know how to drive a stick shift, Felix?
Absolutely. I love driving a stick shift, except in downtown Seattle in the bad traffic or when I want to read my text messages and play with my phone while I'm driving.
Okay. So the yes to a stick shift, and when did you learn how?
When I was 19.
Jacob, stick shift. Can you drive a stick shift?
I cannot. My dad tried to teach me once when I was in high school, and it didn't really stick.
My mom said that there were three things or four things you needed to know how to do when you were to be a man. One, that's wrong. What are you laughing at?
No, I mean, I presume I know what's coming.
She wasn't talking about you.
It's true.
You ready? Tie a bow tie.
Yeah, check.
Ride a horse.
Check.
Drive a stick shift.
Check.
And fire a rifle.
I can do 2 out of 4. I
okay.
Think.
Just quick down in the basement.
Hey, Andrew.
Yeah.
I'm coming down.
Okay.
Have you been Febrezing? It smells like Febreze down here.
Yeah, I've got some nice scented candles.
Is that sandalwood?
Yes, actually.
Do you know how to drive a stick shift?
I do not.
Okay. You ever want to learn?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure thing.
Millennial in the basement. Stick shift index, where people do drive a stick shift in America. This study has come out. It's absolutely worthless, but here we go.
Yes. The most popular car features are not a stick shift anymore. It's the Bluetooth, right? Using the hands-free stuff. But the state where purchases of cars are most likely to include a stick shift is New Mexico's number one.
Uh-huh.
There's no information provided as to why this might be, right? Idaho's number two.
Yeah, it is.
And then what would you think would be next? Colorado, maybe Wyoming?
Somewhere.
Rhode Island. Makes no sense whatsoever. Then Utah. Okay, that's good. Number four. And my theory would be that in mountainous states where you have curvy two-lane roads, it's great to have a stick shift. You can it's safer, it's faster, it's more efficient, right? And number five, the evergreen state.
So the fact that somebody tries to teach their kid to drive a stick shift, I want my kids to learn how to drive it because I want to give that Porsche to my son or my daughter. Mm-hmm. And neither one of them is inspired in any way or motivated to learn to drive a stick. I said, I'll give you this car. When I'm dead and gone, you can have it. But learn how to drive a stick shift. I mean, my dad taught me. He said the best place to learn how to drive a stick shift is on a hill. So he took us out to Rose Lane, and he would your car on a steep incline, popping the clutch over and over and over again. And every time I would fail, he would take his fist and pound it up into the ceiling of the car. Till finally, the light thing and the plastic thing.
Dome light.
The dome light broke off the ceiling because he had kept continuously pounding the thing. So eventually, after about a half an hour, I learned how to drive the stick shift. And then for the next 4 years, the dome light hung there like a hangman's noose.
Nice.
And when you'd open the door, the thing would swing around like a disco light.
I learned to drive a stick shift again, I think, when my brothers taught me. But it was hit or miss, right? It was you could pass or fail, right? The description of how you drive a stick shift and how you actually do it, there's no connection. It's like you release the clutch. Does that mean you're pressing the pedal in or letting the pedal out? And then as it's catching, give it some gas and then release. I think it's a really hard thing to teach, and it's just you have to go out by yourself in a flat parking lot and release the clutch without touching the gas. That's the click and clack method. My second favorite show after Tom and Curly is the click and clack.
You know that you're not doing well when you can smell something burning.
Yes, and right. It smells like asbestos.
Or my dad yelling, gas, 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 gas.